Hello and welcome to another live recording of Beyond the Session with Aisha. My name is Aisha, your host of the business podcast for mental health therapists that want to keep the private practice they work so hard to build. I love doing these live podcast episodes because it allows me to really talk, not necessarily in a stream of consciousness, but in a way that elicits natural conversation. So for those of you that are tuning in live, do not hesitate to raise your hand to ask any questions that come up along the way. I will pause because that is the benefit of post-production. You could always clip and edit and adjust things so that it sounds smooth on the replay. So today, we are talking about the five social media strategies that therapists need to stop ASAP. And one of the reasons why I picked this topic is because there are a lot of private practice owners that are so hesitant to use social media marketing strategies, one of which you heard me talk about on yesterday's episode of this trend that social media is fake. They don't want to come off as inauthentic. And as you heard me detail, there really is only a few ways that you could come off as being inauthentic, and that is really admitting to people, or at least declaring, that all of your content up until that point was just a facade. I mean, you know, as business owners, that the one way that we can effectively build know, like, and trust is being honest with our clients about what it's going to be like for them to go through a mental health journey with us and work towards their goals, challenges, and aspirations. So if you're participating in a trend that's claiming that social media is fake, you're presenting it as if you were fake the entire time. And sure, you might have people rooting for you and saying, yes, thanks for admitting it. But at the end of the day, if you are using social media to promote your business and then saying that it's a fake platform, then why wouldn't someone ask you the next question, which is, well, then why are you here if you're so real? So resist the urge, if at all possible, to not do this trend. Inherently, I don't think trends are problematic, but this one is definitely one to avoid. So that allows me to dovetail right into one of the first strategies that I think you need to avoid when you are running a mental health practice, and that is copying other people's content. So creating or using trends in your social media content is not inherently copying, right? Like, you're jumping on a bandwagon, so to speak, and noticing that people are getting a lot of traction and using certain sounds and music and catchphrases and one-liners. And you're like, wow, they're getting a lot of traction. They're getting a lot of engagement and views. Why don't I use that and see how my audience responds? The problem with taking it a step further and just flat out copying someone is most of the time when people are being copycats, for lack of a better word, they're not actually adding the original creator of that trend. And so that's where you end up building up this beef with someone that you most likely don't even know on the internet. You want to build community. And the last thing you want to do is burn a bridge. So when you are creating your social media content, resist the urge to copy and paste someone else's content. Make it your own if at all possible. And if you can't think creatively enough to make it your own, then don't use it. You know that it's not a strong enough idea to carry your messaging. The other thing about copying other people's content, and I'm not even kidding, I will post the TikTok that I saw just this morning where there was a content creator that called somebody out and said, you know, and tagged the person, named them by name, and said, you copied me. And so that creator who was accused of copying that person responded with a stitch. That's how you connect videos together, for those of you that are not on TikTok. And the accused person said, hey, you know, thanks for tagging me and letting me know. I actually didn't copy you. You were participating in a trend. And she had receipts. She had screenshots of all of the other female creators that were using the very similar trend. And then she called it out and said, you actually weren't the original creator. It was this person from back in January, I believe. So if anything, you copied her, and I apologize for giving you credit. I should have given this other creator credit. So notice how these two people who did not know each other, but the way that TikTok is organized is that it will organize people. Sometimes the original creator will be in the top left corner, and then other times it'll be the most popular video that will show up, and that way people will know, oh, this is the model for the trend. So if you are following a trend, and I did one last week, it was a voiceover trend, and people were the original poster was encouraging people to do it. Like in the comment section, people were like, yeah, I want to do this. And it was about creating content and not being afraid to do it. And so that was more or less like a battle cry for people to be like, you know what? I am going to create content. I'm not going to be shy anymore. So for those of you that are just tuning in, I just want to share with you, you know, tech glitches are bound to happen, and I love the idea of having backup audio. And so I have a backup audio of what we're talking about today. And these are some of the things that I will share with you on the behind the scenes content if you're an email newsletter subscriber. One of the reasons why it's so important to not copy other people's content on social media or in general is that you are degrading the goodwill that you've already built up to that point. So when it comes to being a mental health therapist, trust is everything. That is how we build rapport. And so if your clients are witnessing you essentially ripping off other people's content and not giving them credit and then being called out for it, then the wheels start to turn a little bit, and they may never say anything to you. They might say, you know what, if they're doing that out in the open and in public, what's going to happen behind closed doors when I show up for therapy with them? So this is the reason why I encourage you to think very intentionally about the trends that you're using so that you're not getting caught up in a sticky situation. The other reason why I think it's super important to create original content, and that's what we're really talking about, is because when you're creating original content, it activates a different part of your brain because you're being creative. You're requiring yourself to think outside the box. And people are going to relate to you if they've never seen what you're talking about before, or the way in which you talk about it is going to be unique enough to them. And that's going to make you stand out. We know from the 7-day visibility challenge that one of the key components of being visible is standing out. And you can stand out in your social media marketing strategies. You can also stand out on your website. This is why I encourage all of you to select a specialty and to niche in your mental health business, because by doing that, people are going to remember who you are for all the right reasons. And that is what's going to take a future client to be a current client on your caseload. The second strategy that I think you need to stop ASAP when it comes to social media marketing is posting and ghosting. Your audience decided to follow you on social media because they want to hear from you. And one of the biggest things that I hear from therapists is, I feel like I'm posting too much. And my question back to that is, well, how do you know? Is it because someone told you you're posting too much? If that's the case, they can unfollow you. They can mute your content for a certain period of time. Pretty much on most social media platforms, and I listed the most popular ones on the episode that aired yesterday, you can mute an account without having to unfollow them. So give them that option if they start complaining. There's a fun little phrase that people use a lot on TikTok where, you know, someone will get upset with a creator in the comments and they'll say, I'm leaving, I'm never coming back, I'm not going to follow you anymore. And, you know, the appropriate response is, you don't have to announce your departure. You can leave quietly. So sometimes people are going to rock and roll if they feel upset or disturbed by what you're posting, and that's their prerogative. You don't want to stop yourself from posting on social media because you're overthinking the idea that you're posting too much. And if you think you're posting too much, my other question for you is, well, are you getting results on your posting schedule? Maybe it's not that you're posting too much. Maybe it's the content that you're posting that's not as engaging as it could be. So when we look at your social media engagement, you can define this in different ways, but most of the social media platforms have an analytics dashboard that you can see how many likes, how many follows, subscribes. Reposts are a big content analytic here in LinkedIn. And so that brings me to my third social media strategy that therapists need to stop ASAP is ignoring your analytics. You have to know your numbers to know whether or not your content is landing with your target audience. If you're ignoring the numbers because you've convinced yourself that you're not good at math and, you know, you're allergic to numbers and I've never been good with that, you are speaking a lot of limiting beliefs, and you know what that means. There's an opportunity to see things differently. If you feel uncomfortable with analytics and you don't know how to read them, that's why I'm here. You can sign up for a strategy call to understand why your social media content is not getting you the results that you want, and we'll talk it out and have you walk away after 90 minutes with a solid plan so that you're not feeling lost and confused or even resentful about social media.
So the next thing that therapists need to stop doing when it comes to their social media marketing strategies is only posting lip syncs and faceless posts. And this is something that a lot of therapists who feel insecure about the sound of their voice actually fall into. If you don't show your face, or at the very least use voiceovers or B-roll in your content intermittently, people are not going to get to know you for the therapist that they're going to hire down the road. There are many creators outside of the mental health space whose whole platform is based on lip syncs, and that might work for them because they are not running a business, or they're not running a business that relies on them to be the face of the company. But put yourself in a future client's shoes for a moment. You're excited, you've seen this therapist, you've bonded, you've connected over their content, and you're inspired to finally say yes to working with them. They want to build up that rapport before starting therapy, and your mental health content is going to allow them to do that. When we talk about know, like, and trust, that is an element of what we're talking about, building up that rapport beyond the session. And you can do this effectively if your content is engaging enough and if you're showing your face and using your natural voice. They can be a lot of fun to do lip syncs. I did one not too long ago. Yet, when you are a mental health business owner, it's important to show a sneak peek into what it's like to actually work with you. So if there's a nice balance between the different types of content you're creating, then that's a fantastic start. But if a majority of your content is no face, no voice, or anything, at the very least, post your profile photo, then people are going to be able to connect with you in a different way.
There is a play therapist that I recently came across her content, and I'll link that in the show notes, where her whole platform is her having these play sessions where she is the therapist, and then she is also the child, and she is modeling for the things that she is seeing in her sessions to help parents understand how she's going to give them feedback about what their child is doing in sessions. Because I know firsthand that the play therapists that I've worked with, it's hard for them to figure out how to convey to the parents of the children they want to work with that play therapy is actually effective and is going to elicit some insight and some clinical feedback about how their child is functioning at home. And so the fact that she's modeling this in her social media content on TikTok, in videos, using her voice, this is so powerful. The other thing that you can do to keep your content more authentic, if showing your voice is kind of jumping off into the deep end, is filming in your office space. If you are offering in-person sessions, why not do scenes, a video, B-roll, voices or no voices, or even creating your own stock imagery in your office, because that's the space that your therapy clients are going to engage with when they hire you. That's warming them up. That's building rapport before they even step into the space. It's allowing them to feel comfortable and confident about the decision that they made. One of the big things that is just on my list of big no-nos and this list of five, and I actually added a sixth one, complaining about therapy seekers online. This really grinds my gears. I have a very low tolerance for people who are complaining about the people that are going to help them sustain their business. And frankly, these are the same people who complain about not having enough clients. So make that make sense. You're upset that you don't have enough clients, and yet you're complaining about the people that are reaching out to you for therapy. That is a problem of your own making. And so instead of being in a position where you're frustrated and overwhelmed by the fact that people are not following, as according to some people, etiquette, which, you know, that's a different conversation for a different day that I will climb off my high horse for now. But if you feel like therapy seekers are not behaving, quote unquote, appropriately to ask you for therapy, guess what? You have a hole in your system. You need to create a system and boundaries and clearly communicate what you expect. How are they supposed to know that it is not okay with you to call you 5 times back to back, right? Do you ask them to leave a voicemail message? Do you let them know that the only way that you're going to call them back is by leaving a voicemail? Do you have that on your website? Do you even have a website? So there are so many different things that are within your control, and the frustration that is building up is something that you can resolve pretty quickly. That is another thing that I talk a lot about with my coaching clients. It's running your private practice is not only about filling your caseload and serving your clients. There are a lot of business things that have to go in to running your mental health business. And it comes down to communication expectations. How much does it cost to work with you? Making sure that they understand where your office is located. The list goes on and on and on. So if you have found yourself in a situation where you are resenting the people that are reaching out for therapy with you, knowing that you need them in order to run your business effectively, you have two options. Either close your caseload and say you're not accepting any new clients, and seek out additional support from either case consultation, clinical supervision, if you're not independently licensed, or maybe you need to take some time away from your practice to get yourself together. Because if you're taking it out on people that are not paying you, I don't want to imagine what would happen if you get frustrated with a client that doesn't respect your boundaries, right? And, you know, I made a TikTok video about this, commenting on something that someone was venting about therapy seekers, and they were being very, very open and very candid about it. So, you know, my philosophy is if you're posting about it on the internet and you're posting about it on a place like LinkedIn where it's connected to your business and your name, you know, I'm not going to dox you. I'm gonna X out your name because I do want people to learn from your experience so that they don't make the same mistakes. And that's why I think it is so important to have community around you, because the days that you are struggling, you're gonna wanna vent, and you deserve to vent. But venting on the internet is not a good way to go. You can, like I said, vent to your therapist, vent in case consultation or clinical supervision. And there are times where my coaching clients vent to me about what's happening in their business. That is the reality of being a human being, let alone a business owner. Everything is not going to be rainbows and sunshine. We can't walk through life with rose-colored glasses on. We have to recognize the fact that there are days that are going to be hard. But if you are not managing that difficulty in an effective way, you're actually sabotaging your growth. So before I get to the sixth social media strategy that therapists need to stop ASAP, I'm going to pause to see if we have any questions from the audience. So all you have to do is raise your hand, and then I will bring you up on stage. I'll give you some space to introduce yourself, tell us where you're tuning in from and what your clinical specialty is, and then you can ask your question. So let's dive in. We have about 20 minutes left of this live recording of Beyond the Session with Aisha. Welcome, Claire. So glad to see you here. Erin, do you have any questions or thoughts that have popped up?
Hey, Aisha. Yes. So my name is Erin, and I'm tuning in from North Carolina, and I am an OCD specialist. And I think for my social media strategies, I've mostly used LinkedIn and YouTube. I think one of the things that you and I were discussing recently was adding more content to my LinkedIn posts when I'm advertising my latest podcast episode. And so with the, just kind of revisiting that topic. So with the sound bites, how do I determine, I guess, what a good sound bite would be when advertising on social media?
Yeah, that's a great question. So for those of you that don't have a podcast, there are many creative ways that you can let people know about the podcast episode specifically and just about your show overall. So the sound bites that Erin is referencing, you might also be familiar with the term audiograms, where it is taking an audio clip from your podcast and then putting it visually so that people can have something to look at. Maybe you have the captions in addition to the sound waves moving in coordination with your words, or you'll have like a standalone image like the cover image of the episode or maybe even a quote. So when you are promoting your podcast on a platform like LinkedIn, it's important for people to know, what do you want them to get out of that snippet that you shared with them? Is it a cliffhanger where you're just like, ooh, what's next? I have to listen to this episode. Or are you trying to pull a fact out of it? So for example, if you create a podcast episode about OCD where you cover three things, you could do a LinkedIn post that covers one thing very briefly and say, to learn more about the other two, I cover them on this week's episode of the podcast. Click below to listen to the full episode. So that way, they're getting a preview of what they can expect. And if they're interested in listening to the following parts of the episode, they're going to click through. If not, you can see that engagement on some platforms. I don't know if LinkedIn gives analytics for click-through rates as far as links that you put in your post, but it would be a nice analytic for them to add, because you want to know if people are actually clicking the links, when they're clicking the links, right? How many times people have clicked a link. So that's one idea. Another idea that you could do, especially when you have guests on your podcast, is making sure that you're featuring the face of the guest on your show in addition to your face, so that they're associating your show with you and they're recognizing like, oh, this is a guest, like this isn't someone that's regularly on the show, unless you have like a frequent recurring guest. And one more idea that I could give you is, there is a platform called Riverside.fm, and I use that for filming my guests on my podcast. And the beautiful thing about Riverside is you have to record the video once, and then it will allow you to reframe the video automatically for other platforms. So it will record it. Yeah, it's so amazing, because this way you can repurpose the video and have your guest on the top in video form, them talking, you on the bottom, or vice versa. You can flip it. Then you just do a click of a button and you can repurpose that same video clip for YouTube, because we know that YouTube is more of the horizontal video as opposed to the vertical video on TikTok and Instagram Reels. And then we know YouTube Shorts, right? So if you take your entire interview, let's say the interview lasted for 23 minutes, you can take little sound bites from that episode and put them in YouTube Shorts. So it's attracting the people that might not listen to the whole episode in its entirety, but they're gonna watch the highlight reel of it. And Riverside is amazing because it will recommend the clips that they think are the most engaging. So it's fun how they're using AI to assist you with that. And Heather is actually using that for her podcast, Grief is the New Normal.
Okay, now the last question I have, and it may be just a matter of preference, but I have seen like some content creators will have multiple slides or photos, if you will, like a carousel almost, of like their advertising their podcast episode. And well, I guess it's kind of a two-part question. So part one is like, should I consider having multiple photos associated with a single post? And then Well, now I lost my train of thought. We'll start with part one. I'll think of the part two.
Yeah. So everyone who's listening in, what Erin is describing is called a carousel, where you have a series of either images or videos in one post, and someone can swipe left or right to review, read, or listen to those posts or watch. So creating carousels, it really just depends on how often you're putting them in front of your audience and how engaging they are. So I think they're worth experimenting with. I'm going to be experimenting with carousels this quarter, and you know, your analytics are really going to be able to show you whether or not they're engaging enough with your audience based on, you know, how many people are reposting them. I think that's a great way to educate people without them having to listen to the podcast. When we talk about accessibility as far as mental health content goes, this is another way for you to be accessible, where you can actually have the opportunity to say, you know what, everybody's not going to listen to a podcast, maybe, or maybe not in full, but I'm going to transfer that material into written form so that people can still get the nuggets that I want them to get. So that is also the benefit of doing a text-based carousel, whether it's on LinkedIn. Carousels are also available now on TikTok. They've been available for the longest time on Instagram. I haven't seen people really use them on Facebook, because Facebook actually posts them almost like a grid in photo form. But, you know, maybe they'll switch it up since Facebook and Instagram are under the Meta umbrella. But I definitely think it's worth exploring for you, for sure, for your podcast.
All right. Now, my last question is, when it comes to posting images for your posts, like, sometimes I hear, like, you know, keep it consistent, but then I also like a little bit of, like, diversity and mixing it up, and I feel like I'm still testing out different, like, Canva designs, for example, so I'm kind of figuring out which way do I go with this, or maybe do I have, like, a, let's say, a consistent logo or icon that I put with my images, so then my audience knows, oh, this is Erin's product or post.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to gauge, like, what kind of designs do I stick with? Do I stay consistent? Do I mix it up? Or do I bring in an element that stays consistent?
Yes. So the visual of your content is going to build that familiarity, and it's actually going to build that know, like, and trust factor. So I think while you're in this experimentation phase, I would say have fun with it, but notice the colors that you're already using, and like your welcome guide, and you know, and other elements within your business that your current clients already have, and just see, you know, if I consistently use this, is this going to be familiar to them when they become a current client? The answer is yes. I wouldn't put so much pressure on yourself to keep everything so consistent that it's stressing you out. I'm more so encouraging you to just get the content out there, and we can always clean it up later, because you're going to be reposting and repurposing this content. So no one's going to remember that last week you used a daffodil yellow and this week you're using lilac. They just know that Erin is the OCD okay. specialist that I want to listen to and learn from.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. Great questions. All right, we have Claire. Welcome, Claire. If you'd like to take yourself off mute and tell us where you're tuning in from, what your specialty is, population you're serving, and then ask your question.
Hey there, this is so fun. This is my first time joining a live event like this. I'm tuning in from coastal Virginia, and I work in eating disorder treatment at the PHP and IOP levels of care. Wednesdays is my early day, so you will hear my dog in the background. I apologize for that. So the question that I care a lot about, connecting with peers in the mental health space, in the healthcare worker space, and engaging in, like, peer supervision, and just speaking on, you know, that, just what it is to navigate the process of coming into your own as a clinician through, you know, all the stages of development. That's really meaningful to me. And also, clients will find you, current clients or potential clients will find you on the internet. And so I'm curious if you have any thoughts or reflections on how to balance. I care very much about having my messaging kind of speak towards both, like towards both other professionals as well as to people, you know, not necessarily, I don't, you know, necessarily want to use social media to market to potential clients, but I'm aware that people who are not in the mental health space, but are rather looking for content that would be meaningful to them in terms of what it is that they might want to learn about, are also going to view it. How do you recommend handling that? Or what are your thoughts around that for professionals?
Yeah, this is a lovely question, Claire. And I'm curious to know, with your experience in the eating disorder community and having the IOP experience, are you an independent practitioner or are you a part of an organization, hospital setting?
Both. So I, in the PHP and IOP level of care, I work in, I mean, essentially it's a private practice, but it's in, you know, it's not my business. I work for somebody else. It is not a hospital system that I work in, but it is a partial hospitalization program that emerged out of a person's private practice. And then I also see outpatient clients who are not eating disorder specific in private practice independently.
Okay. So who are you most concerned about? The patients that you're seeing in partial hospitalization or the patients that you're seeing in your private practice that are unrelated to eating disorders?
It's more so that like the nature of the reflections are just very different. Like having a reflection about what the experience is being a counselor that would be very meaningful to another professional is not appropriate for a current or potential client to have insight into, if that makes sense. So it's not so much the eating disorder specific lens that I'm concerned with. It's more of just as I've evolved in my work, I've like cared very much about speaking about, you know, my professional development, and those are two very different audiences.
Yeah. So this is the conundrum that I'm hearing, is that you want to speak candidly about what it's like to be a clinician, and yet speaking candidly could also hinder the therapeutic relationship with future or current clients that you have in either sector.
Yeah. It feels, I don't know, not helpful. Potentially not helpful. I'm not really sure what I think about it.
Yeah. So this is not necessarily similar to what I said earlier, and there will be a replay of this tomorrow.
Oh, perfect.
It's not similar to what I addressed earlier, which is about therapists complaining about therapy seekers or current clients. It sounds like you're trying to have clinical conversations,
yes,
about your work. And so there's a couple of ways, yeah. So there's a couple of ways that you could do this with integrity, and it's having a conversation starter on a social media platform. I know you said that you're not using social media, but there are some people that are listening to this, and then having more of a closed environment where you can control who is going to see the content that you're creating. So one way to do this is to create a subscriber only email newsletter where that's where you're having these conversations, where you can still speak freely. It's more or less you creating the content and putting it out there, and people could engage with it by opening and digging into it more, responding to your emails. But that is the easiest and effective way to do what you're trying to do without potentially harming the therapeutic relationship of future and current clients.
Okay, yeah.
And there are free email newsletter platforms out there. Like LinkedIn is still in its experimentation phase with its newsletter, so that's not private. That exists and it's owned by LinkedIn. So you don't have an audience that you could, you know, curate to the point where you're like, oh, I only want X person to see it instead of Y. You could create a page on LinkedIn, depending on the settings on your LinkedIn profile and admit people to like this private LinkedIn page or LinkedIn group. And then that way it kind of functions like a Facebook group, but it would be important for you to just manage those group dynamics if people who do not see your clinical work in the same way and do want to complain about clients. Like that's where you get into that slippery slope. So creating an off platform, an off social media newsletter using Substack. Substack is really popular right now and they are currently allowing people to create email newsletters for free and then you can monetize those. I recommend for people that have their own private practice to actually take it a step further and use their email marketing to actually support their business endeavors because it allows you to build up wait lists very naturally. It kind of crosses off another box for any future needs for client work or case consultation if that's what you want to offer to your colleagues down the road. And the two platforms that I recommend for that are Flowdesk and ConvertKit, and I use both of those. Flowdesk for my private practice and then ConvertKit for my consulting firm.
Yeah, that makes sense. I've taken a similar approach. I do have social media and use it like in a professional context. I'm just not using it to try to get clients. That's just not consistent with how I personally am using it right now, but I do also have Flowdesk and I've started to sort of differentiate those two aspects just on Instagram on the most basic level using the close friends feature. Yes. Where it's like you decide who it is that can like get access to that. But I think I'm having a more complicated relationship with it because it's like I believe that there's a world where this doesn't need to be differentiated as stringently, but I can't figure out quite yet what I think about that. It's something that I want to be cautious about and thoughtful about and deliberate about in order to, I'm one person. Mm-hmm. And these are not separate parts of my professional identity. These are companion parts of my professional identity. And I think that, like, there's a world in which all of the things that one does in order to engage like the meaning making process of their own professional development with integrity, that is healthy for individuals who seek therapy to have awareness of, if for no other reason from like an education standpoint, to advise, like, you want somebody who engages in their professional life in this way. You want somebody who's, you know, passionate and convicted and self-aware and engages all of these, you know, processes, like, from an awareness standpoint. But I don't quite know I don't think a lot of people do that. I don't see a ton of examples of it. And so it's just something I'm way more cautious about.
Yeah. And, you know, I think it's unfortunate that more people aren't vocal about it. I do this in my content very openly on my Instagram channel for my therapy practice. And with my current clients, I will tell them, you know, other things that I am doing to advocate for you. And, you know, I specialize in treating anxiety. So making sure that people are not discriminating against folks that have anxiety in the workplace is having these conversations out loud and out in the open. And so they already know that if they happen to follow me on LinkedIn, which, you know, it's their prerogative to do that. You can have any social media policy you want, but it's not going to stop a client from following you or reading your content. And I do the same thing on TikTok too. The reason why I'm on TikTok is to elevate the mental health industry. And the people that are engaging and commenting and saying, hey, can you create a video about this? It's almost split 50-50 between therapy seekers and therapists. And people who are interested in elevating the mental health industry and being advocates. So I don't think you have to stringently separate the communities if you feel comfortable and confident and knowing that you are not going to harm the other by talking about it candidly. And I think there's a way to do that. But there are some conversations, I agree with you, that are there has to be a deeper level of understanding of what case consultation is and clinical supervision is, so that if a therapy seeker does come across your content, they understand like, oh, okay, yeah, this is them supporting each other. But there is a time and a place for it and a depth level that social media as a whole can tolerate. And we know that, right? And even if we think back to the clinicians that have been practicing before the advent of social media, you know, all of us are young enough to remember a time where social media did not exist. Those therapists were still having those meaningful conversations. So just because it's difficult now doesn't mean it's not worth doing and doesn't mean that it can't be done. But I think you're setting a great example for what it actually looks like and trying to make sure that you're maintaining the integrity of the other parts of our work beyond the session, instead of just pretending that like, oh yeah, clients aren't going to find us on the internet. It's like, no, it's the internet. They're going to find you. That's the whole point of
it. Yeah. And I think the one thing I just want to add is that like in no world would I ever bring anything that has anything even remotely to do with case consultation into a social media space. That feels profoundly inappropriate. It sort of started out of like, medical students will do this a lot. They'll continue it into their residency where they're kind of talking about what is the journey of becoming this professional? Mm-hmm. What is that kind of, you know, what is that trajectory like? And so the thing that I'm most passionate about, you know, is speaking about like the first generation college student experience, what it is to be like the first generation of a profession, like a woman with a profession in your lineage. And what kind of like, what is it like to kind of assume that kind of authority for yourself, for your life, for a professional identity and role? And then related to that is like, what is it like to engage sort of systemic barriers within healthcare infrastructures that both make it difficult to assume that identity and also are oppressive toward, you know, the clients that those, that the healthcare industry kind of serves. And so it's like my desire to be, you know, just to contribute to a reflection around that, I hope doesn't need to contraindicate what, you know, how then, you know, therapy seekers, I appreciate the languaging around that. That makes so much sense. How then therapy seekers engage with, like, it then means that they know more about my identity. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. They know more about, you know, or there are transparent conversations about the kind of systems that they might find themselves in or be served by. So that, you know, that's sort of where that, I just wanted to, you know, kind of, you know, clarify the clinical supervision case consultation component. I agree with you. Not on social media. No, that is no place in a social networking kind of environment. But it's that other stuff that, yeah, I do hope I can figure out a way. I appreciate that you're kind of speaking towards the way in which you do that in your own work as kind of like a model of what I might be able to follow for myself.
Yeah, definitely. And don't hesitate to take a peek at the content that I've created around making sure that your values are steeped in what you're doing, not just in session, but beyond the session. Because if your clients don't know where you stand, we're not building that rapport and they're not going to trust us with their lived experience. So there are many, many, many mental health therapists out there that are so transparent about their lived experience. And that actually builds a close bond with therapy seekers, current clients, past clients. And some people are not going to feel comfortable with disclosing, but there is a delicate balance that each of us has, and you can definitely find that. And I talk about this constantly and very upfront and very unapologetic, because I think about the one person that needs to hear what I'm going to share and how that would positively impact their life. And then I'm ready for the other conversations that could happen. And that, you know, nicely dovetails into that sixth bonus social media strategy that I think therapists need to stop doing on the internet overall is trolling each other. There are so many people that are so critical of what they're seeing because it wasn't what we used to do. Like, you know, why are you telling clients that you have a certain diagnosis? And why are you telling us this about your life? And I would never do that. There has to be something that just flashes in that person's mind and just say, you know what? Remember how we said our clients have the right to self-determination? Where our clinicians, our colleagues, our therapists from around the world also have that ability too. And if they have determined that self-disclosure is going to build the therapeutic relationship on and off screen, then allow them to share their story. But it is not fair to criticize them for what they're choosing to do, because that's where their values lie. And that's why when we talk about branding, you know, earlier Erin, you know, positioned this question around visual branding, but we also have to think about the branding that no one sees. And that is sharing our values, allowing people to understand where we are coming from. Context matters. And if we are still leaning into this tabula rasa type of therapy, people are over that. That's why when people are saying this trend, which started this whole series of episodes this week, when people are saying social media is fake, and then in session, your client knows nothing about you, that's fake. People don't want inauthentic therapists anymore. They want to know that the person across the room from them is real and honest and genuine. And you get to decide what that looks like for you within your own comfort zone. So if you are listening to this on the replay, I hope that you have been encouraged not only by Erin's questions and Claire's questions. Thank you so much both for joining us during the live recording of Beyond the Session with Aisha. You can enjoy this recording on Thursday, because episodes are released on Tuesdays and Thursdays. And I hope to see you all next week, where we'll have another fun, exciting topic to explore. If you are not currently an email newsletter subscriber, I would encourage you to subscribe. You can go to aisharshabazz.com/thriving. That will invite you to take a fun, interactive quiz that takes less than a minute to take. It's the path to a thriving private practice. It'll give you some tangible tools to help you identify which of the four paths you're currently navigating. And then I give you concrete details on how to keep going. So if your intention is to build a well-rounded practice so that people know who you are, you're going to have a resource in there where I share with you the 200 values that you can pick from to establish your brand on, and so much more. So I thank you all for joining me today for this lovely episode. And until next time, take care, talk soon, and keep thriving.